Sounds like Michael the tree hugger. Well, there's a monthly feature of the show that's also on PBS. Here, I'm not coming through very loud. Am I okay now? Check, check, mic check. I can't remember his last name at this point. He has some good guests on, and that might be coming up this afternoon. Maybe Gina will fill you in at the top of the hour. My name's Paul Muth. I'm in. And breaking news here from a Bernie Sanders supporter, video of Dick Van Dyke looking elf-like endorsing Bernie Sanders for president. So there you go. Danville native, I guess. That's the extra hook. It's a Danvillian that posted it. Okay, I was trying to find out about a benefit for climate change activism, and it's tomorrow afternoon, which is also when the New Souls are at the Champaign Library. I'll try and find this. It's at Poor Brothers, too, which is right across the street from WEF. So if you were down here in downtown Champaign, you could look in at the studios. I think it's a guy, but it might be a duo. Corduroy, I haven't seen him yet, is playing for a group that's doing some work on climate chaos problems, I'll call it. Because climate change is natural, right? But climate chaos, due to the dipole moment of carbon dioxide and the small but very pivotal amount that's being added, well, gigatons of carbon dioxide, but it's a big atmosphere. It doesn't raise the percentage much, but it has a oversaturating effect because, overwhelming effect because of this thing called the dipole moment of carbon dioxide. It resonates with the light waves and traps the heat. Greenhouse effect was known a century ago. And there are still deniers out there, and I argue with them. I don't know if it's to any event. Last issue brought up and thrown at me was, well, it's the cloud cover that's causing the heating. It's not anything about what we're doing, except that climate change says that since vapor pressure will be raised in climate change, there will be more clouds, which actually gives you another positive feedback loop for climate change if the original Finnish research is true. But that's chicken before the egg. All right, what am I got today? I've got a long segment from Intercepted on Bloomberg. I can't take him seriously as a candidate, but then that's what we said about the other billionaire, the one that's in the White House now. So I've just heard an expletive in the humorous piece. I'm going to try and delete that. So the other thing I have is something I do occasionally. I don't have a Greg Palast thing, and I have an old behind the news that I've sought out on neoliberalism, because KPFA is in fund drive mode, and I think they've gotten hit with an extra expense that they don't know about. WPFW is broadcasting at low power for some reason. They were in their fundraising last time I tuned into the Washington Pacifica station. Anyway, the tower thing hasn't happened here at WEF. We were talking about it for last week. I'll mention again that if you find WEF off the air, go to the online, go to the website, link in, and find out the update on the spanking new antenna going up on a new tower. The old tower is rusting out. WEF is the only transmitter still on, still using the rusting out from the inside tower that apparently wasn't maintained well. Somebody painted over the weep holes. Okay. Too much information. Okay, the other thing that has been here in the studio to mention is that WEF will be low power after the thing happens while the contours are studied and examined to make sure that when Full power is applied. It won't interfere with this Covington, Indiana station that has got a unique high power authorization. Even though they were interfering with Channel 6 in Indy, but they were a Christian station, so natushpa. The other thing I always mention is that when WEFT is dark, if you're in the northern part of the listening range, you might hear the Chicago station that's on 90.1, and that is the Moody Bible Institute station, who wanted to get a higher power some time ago, even though they're really blasting now. All right, details. Like I say, go to the website and get the full scoop. And usual features in a college town. This one will resonate, I guess. Mumi Abu-Jamal's got a thought piece in solidarity with the Santa Cruz grad student strike. Amy Goodman's got an interesting piece on in her Breaking the Sound Barrier about single-payer health care. She starts it out with a unique quote that you probably haven't heard. And TextCast, that's the thing from England that I'm going to play, and it sounds kind of odd. It's kind of a monthly feature. I don't know if I got last month's. I'm trying to remember now. Some of it is too European to use, but this one has an assessment of transparency, how easy it is to be a crook in the higher range of financial dealings, which is such an appropriate thing to be discussed, and we can understand why the corporate media doesn't talk about it too much. But we have a money launderer in chief, and the guy he pointed to the takeover for the DNI, the overall intelligence czar, is, I guess he's an ambassador now, and he's apparently was a spokesperson for a guy that's banned from coming to the U.S. because he's an oligarch with shady dealings, kind of guy that would get along, Lev Parnas and Giuliani and Trump, right? Okay, how they can attack anybody for ethics is amazing. I'm not making a brief for a senator from credit card and financial malfeasance, Delaware. But, yeah, it's the stove calling the pot black, as it were. That's my opinion. The opinions you hear are those of the speakers, not necessarily shared. Let's kick it with Mumi Abu-Jamal, like I like to do. Political prisoner who is finally getting his retrial for the whole thing. I don't think there's any dates made yet in that. Go to his prison radio .org where I get these, and they're distributed through Pacifica, of course, as well. 8 minutes in already, geez.
Several years ago, I read a masterful and remarkable book titled Hammer and Hoe by the acclaimed historian Robin Kelly. It's a fascinating history of black workers in the 1930s, working in Alabama, who tried to organize unions and get a few pennies more for their labor, often agricultural work. The landowners, angry that their labor wanted more pay, unleashed really terrorizing repression, state violence against these people, often accomplished with the open aid of groups like the Ku Klux Klan. I thought of that dismal history when I heard just recently of cops beating, clubbing, and breaking bones of UCAL graduate students who are only striking to get the ability to pay their rent. This is especially problematic due to increasing high rents in California. Obviously, one can't equate the grotesque racist violence visited upon black workers during the 30s. Yet what unites these two periods is the presence of state violence against people truly trying to live better lives. In their case, trying to pay rent. A movement is growing in Cali, a movement that may grow to touch all of us. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
Oh, well, I have to talk some more because I said I was going to not endorse but announce this event at the Poor Brothers hosted by Corduroy. Turns out it's associated with Generation Atomic, clean energy through nuclear power. Not something I'm down with, but I guess I'll mention the event that's between 4 and 7 at Poor Brothers. Generation Atomic Movement Mobilizing Alliance and Activist Group works for nonprofit Generation Atomic. I wonder where they get their money from. Grassroots organization from chapters canvassing nationwide for the proliferation of sustainable nuclear energy. I think they need somebody to do copy. Proliferation and nuclear power, they're not a particularly good combination since everyone thinks of how dangerous it is to get a little bit of some isotope and make a dirty bomb. It's the easiest way to improperly use. I don't think that's the argument against nuclear power. The argument nuclear power is something that's in the dismal science of economics called opportunity costs. If you do something with your money, you miss the opportunity to do other things. In my opinion, is the sinking a lot of money into nuclear power and not putting it into the quicker and more decentralized power sources is a bad idea. All right, here's Amy Goodman. But maybe somebody should go down there and bring that up. Since I'm here next door while it's going on, it might be me. Okay, how did that happen? Amy Goodman's Medicare for All is going to be played right now.
Medicare for All should be a reality today. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan and our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. People with low or moderate incomes do not get the same medical attention as those with high incomes. The poor have more sickness, but they get less medical care. So said the President of the United States in a message to Congress. No, that wasn't President Donald Trump in 2020. It was President Harry Truman in 1945, laying out his plan for a national health insurance program and starting a debate that continues today, more than 70 years later. Shortly after Truman's proposal, Republicans gained control of Congress and, along with the powerful American Medical Association, quashed any prospects of national health insurance. President Dwight Eisenhower provided tax credits to businesses that offered insurance to their employees. This corporate welfare, sending taxpayer money to private insurance companies, laid the foundation for the current system. President John F. Kennedy pushed for single-payer health insurance for older Americans, but again, the AMA defeated it. In a 1961 debate between United Auto Workers Union President Walter Reuther and Dr. Edward Annis, a spokesman for the AMA, Annis argued,
"This, sir, is socialism. Whenever the government provides for the people, whether they need it or not, and it calls the terms under which this provision is made, this is socialism."
President Lyndon Baines Johnson won a landslide victory over Republican Barry Goldwater in 1964. His electoral mandate enabled him to push through legislation creating Medicare and Medicaid. Johnson signed the bill in Truman's home in Independence, Missouri. And less than a year later, he hand-delivered the first two Medicare member cards to President Truman and his wife, Bess. Medicare and Medicaid have proven to be among the most successful and popular government programs in U.S. history. Which brings us to today. Central to the Democratic Party's pitched presidential nomination battle is single-payer health care, also known as Medicare for All. Of the candidates remaining in the race, both Senators Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren support Medicare for All. In the simplest terms, this would remove the eligibility age for Medicare, currently 65 years and older, making the benefits available to all. Most other candidates support an expansion of the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare, while ex-Mayor Pete Buttigieg is promoting a hybrid Medicare for All Who Want It plan. When Sanders says, "I wrote the damn bill," he's referring to S-1129, the Medicare for All Act of 2019. Warren's among 14 Senate Democrats who've co-sponsored the bill. Medicare for All would cover all residents of the United States, including undocumented immigrants, from cradle to grave. The medical journal The Lancet recently published an analysis of the bill from the Yale School of Public Health, describing the enormous savings and improved care that would result if enacted. The Yale study found that Medicare for All would save $450 billion annually from current costs of just over $3 trillion, that's trillion with a T. Improved healthcare delivery would also save the lives of an estimated 68,000 people per year, people who die simply because they can't afford to see a doctor. In addition to costing less, overall health outcomes would improve, most notably for the 38 million currently uninsured people and the additional 41 million people who are underinsured, prevented from accessing their insurance because of deductibles, copays, out-of-pocket expenses, and so-called out-of-network costs. Presidential candidate Senator Sanders is constantly asked on the debate stages if he would have to raise taxes to fund Medicare for All. Then he's denied enough time to provide a complete answer. As the Yale study explains, taxes would go up primarily for the richest 1% of the population, but overall health care costs would go down. Individuals, families, and employers would never have to pay a health insurance premium again. Copays, deductibles, and other costs would be eliminated. Single-payer health care would essentially put the U.S.'s for-profit health insurance corporations out of business, cutting hundreds of billions of dollars in wasteful overhead and profit-taking. It would also allow the U.S. government to negotiate pharmaceutical costs, which it currently is legally barred from doing, saving tens or hundreds of billions of dollars more. The Kaiser Family Foundation recently released results of national polling on single-payer health care, which found that more than half of Americans support such a plan. Among Democrats, the support jumps to 87%. The United States healthcare system currently costs twice as much per capita as any other industrialized country. Yet health outcomes are worse, with the U.S. ranking lower than over 30 other countries.
Okay, I'm sorry. Let's see if I can pick that back up. Apparently not. So we're going to hear a little repeat of a little bit of this.
Medicare for All should be a reality today. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan and our weekly breaking...
Okay, well... I guess I have to push on because I've talked too much already. That Lancet article was cited in the debate. I still don't watch those. Let me read the last bit of it. And I believe this overlaps just a little bit. Sanders is constantly asked on debate stages if he would raise taxes to fund Medicare for all, and then he's denied enough time to provide a complete answer. As the Yale study explains, taxes would go up, but primarily for the richest 1%. But overall health costs would go down. Individuals, families, and employers would never have to pay an insurance premium again. Copays, deductibles, and other costs would be eliminated. Single-payer health care would essentially put the U.S.'s for-profit health insurance corporations out of business, cutting hundreds of billions of dollars in wasteful overhead and profit-taking. It would also allow the U.S. government to negotiate pharmaceutical costs, which is currently is legally banned from doing, saving tens or hundreds of billions more. The Kaiser Foundation recently released results of national polling on single-payer health care, which found that more than half of Americans support such a plan. Among Democrats, the support jumps to 87%. The health care system currently costs twice as much per capita as any other industrialized country, yet health outcomes are worse, with the U.S. ranking lower than over 30 other countries, with higher rates of infant mortality and lower life expectancy. From Canada to Costa Rica, universal health care is a reality. Perhaps when the reality TV show of the U.S. presidential election is over, sensible national health policy can become a reality here, too. Well, that's aspirational. Sorry about the snafu there. I was researching a book called The New Fire, which was screened by this group that claims nuclear is the answer. Their website says that they are an independent documentary. I'm very skeptical of all of this. As you can hear, the nuclear industry has spent a lot of money doing quite a bit like what Exxon and the petrochemical cohort have done. All right. Well, more of that anon. I guess I shouldn't try to do that. Well, I'm trying to at least keep some continuity here. I mentioned TaxCast. We're definitely going to hear that. We should have time for the bulk of the material from Jeremy Scahill's The Intercepted. Includes NYU professor, New York University professor, whose last name is Singh, S-I-N-G-H, who I've heard before interviewed by Jeremy, and he's really good. And the broader issues are discussed, not just vagaries of Bloomberg, which is a lot of what is discussed in the commentary. I might have to see about editing a little bit on the fly here, since I've been boffo today. Hope you're doing well, and here's Naomi Fowler. It's definitely from the UK. I think this is pretty well done, actually, though.
Criticized, and our expert team uses objective criteria and data to assess the world's worst offenders, those countries that are selling financial and legal secrecy services which the wealthy, multinationals and criminals use to make the world a worse place to live in than it really should be. Countries are ranked in a kind of role of dishonor by combining their secrecy level scores along with the share of the global market they've carved out for themselves. This is a list you don't want your country to be at the top of. Before I give you the top 10, here are some of the indicators each of the 133 countries in the index have been assessed on. Do they make companies, trusts and foundations reveal their true owners? Are annual accounts made available online in open data format? Do their rules comply with anti-money laundering standards? Is there a public register of the ownership of and annual accounts of limited partnerships and of real estate? Is there a central register identifying people using freeboards for the storage of high-value assets? Do they have banking secrecy rules with possible prison terms for banking whistleblowers? Are tax court verdicts and proceedings made public? Do they sell harmful tax residency and citizenship schemes? Do they give public access to country-by-country reports filed by companies from around the world? Do they allow unregistered bearer shares? We'll have more on those later. Do they publish statistics on their cross-border financial and economic activities? How much transparency do they have for the extractive industries and mining contracts? So there you go. All of these things and more these countries have been assessed on. And so here they are, the top 10 world's worst global offenders. Catapulting into first place, we have the Cayman Islands, a British overseas territory. It's massively increased its share of the global secrecy market, and it's increased its secrecy score to 76 out of 100. In second place, the United States. It remains second, hot on the heels of Cayman, after further increasing its supply of financial secrecy to the world by 15%. The country is still a pariah state, refusing to sign up to various agreements on information exchange that most other major economies have signed up to. In third place, this time, Switzerland, after years of being ranked the world's number one worst offender by the Financial Secrecy Index, it's lost a bit of its market share and it's reluctantly signed more information exchange agreements with other countries. Its secrecy score is still high, 74 out of 100. So, Swiss secrecy is still a thing. In fourth place, once again, it's Hong Kong. It has finally accepted participating in automatic information exchange, but it's still a big global offender. In fifth place, once again, Singapore, with a slightly improved secrecy score and slightly increased share of the market. In sixth place, it's Luxembourg, a huge player, but with a bit more transparency now on multinational business. In seventh place is Japan, which has zoomed up several places since the last index when it was ranked 13th. In eighth place is the Netherlands, a big story here, climbing several places with slightly higher secrecy score and an increased share of the market. In ninth place, up several places since last time, the British Virgin Islands, another British overseas territory. And in 10th place, the United Arab Emirates, a particularly aggressive, highly secretive jurisdiction on the rise. I have to tell TaxCast listeners in Britain that the UK is one of the worst stories of the 2020 Financial Secrecy Index. For all those wondering how Brexit might pan out and the general direction of travel, it's not looking good. On paper, of course, as usual, its transparency levels look okay, with a secrecy score this time 46 out of 100. But as we always remind people, if we were to combine the United Kingdom with all its crown dependencies and overseas territories, in other words, its satellite havens, the UK would easily be number one on the index. That's still the case. Its satellite havens are vital because much of the really dirty stuff happens out there before it arrives all squeaky clean in London. The same day we released our Financial Secrecy Index, the European Union decided to blacklist British overseas territory, the Cayman Islands, which, as you know, is also our number one worst offender this time. The European Union's blacklists have long been politicised in the sense that they've left their own member states off the list. And you have to ask, are big offenders like the United States on the European Union's blacklist? Of course not. But now that Britain has left the European Union, well, it looks like Cayman took a hit. And that is fully deserved. But now the European Union should do all this properly and look at all the other offenders, including its own member states. Let's give you some good news first on the index. I'm joined by John Christensen of the Tax Justice Network. John, the global trend. On average, countries assessed in the 2020 index reduced their contribution to global financial secrecy by 7%. And that demonstrates that policies by many governments are actually going, albeit slowly, in the right direction of reducing secrecy.
Yeah, the Financial Secrecy Index was first published in 2009, so we now have over 10 years of data to draw on. And yes, there is indeed some good news, because since 2009 we've seen a really significant pushback against offshore secrecy, with new global measures, like country-by-country reporting and automatic information exchange between tax authorities, and these are now establishing themselves as global norms. We've also seen progress towards greater transparency of company ownership. Public ownership registries are now a legal requirement in the European Union. Even though that picture's patchy and too many secrecy jurisdictions are still refusing to cooperate with new measures to make their company registries publicly searchable, the overall picture is a positive one, and it shows, as far as I'm concerned, that civil society can really make a difference. So that's the good news story we can draw from the 2020 Financial Secrecy Index.
Right, right. But there are plenty of countries bucking that global trend, unfortunately, like the Cayman Islands at number one, and what the Tax Justice Network's calling an Anglo-American axis of secrecy, the United States and the UK. And another important point, if you look at the many scandals, starting with the Panama Papers and most recently Luanda Leaks in Angola, you can see that, yes, Angola has the second highest financial secrecy score in the countries assessed in the index. But then if you take a look at the huge network the former Angola president's daughter had, she operated using 41 countries, and many of them are powerful, wealthy countries, which tick many of the financial transparency boxes. And if you add to the fact that OECD member countries are responsible for 49% of all global financial secrecy, and yet, of course, the OECD, largely a rich country club, as we call them, they are responsible for setting the international tax rules.
Yeah, this is an extraordinary and really unacceptable situation. The OECD has been making the rules for well over half a century, and OECD countries generally follow what I call the golden rule. Those who have the gold make the rules. Non-OECD countries should recognise that OECD member states are only interested in protecting their own interests and cannot even begin to pretend that they are representing the interests of the rest of the world. So if the non-OECD member states, in other words, the rest of the world, want to become rule makers, not rule takers, then they need to reject the pretensions of the OECD member states to be the rule makers. We need a global legitimate rule maker, and ideally it should be the United Nations that takes on the role of making the rules for the whole of the world.
We're going to leave that to your interest if you want to chase down TaxCast at taxjustice.net.uk. And they go on to do area by area, including a fairly long section on the U.S. and the various states that are the biggest. Delaware, historically, as I pointed to earlier, but Nevada and Montana are in the tax avoidance, hot money, secret money business in a pretty big way. Yeah, scams like that spread. Hopefully they'll overwhelm and crash. Something that happened on campus this week that I missed, there was a divestment resolution passed. Violations of human rights and university investments passed through the Student Senate, 20 in favor, 9 against, and 7 abstentions at 12:30 a.m. Thursday. 5.5 hours of public comment, amendment discussion, and Senate debate was pretty intense, I guess. It specifically calls the university to divest from three leading defense companies, Elbit Systems, E-L-B-I-T, don't know anything about it, more familiar, Northrop Grumman and Raytheon, all of which have supplied weapons of our defense, quote, and technology to Israel. It mentions supply of weapons to Chinese, Brazilian, Chilean, and Honduran governments. It was quite contentious, but it did pass eventually, for what it's worth, and I'm glad it did. 34 speakers, 8 in favor, 26 against. That's who was on the list of speakers. All right, that was from a DI article I should credit. Now, let's see, I was thinking about editing this on the fly. I think I'll just tell you this is from the, not the latest, they had an extra edition about Guantanamo, about Gitmo. There have been some revelations that are getting short shrift in the press since the reality TV show of the electoral system is dominating so much. So I'll have to excerpt this as I can at the end and commend it to your attention, The Intercepted. Been hearing a lot of stuff from Gray Zone and Max Blumenthal, who I respect immensely, undermining all the credibility of The Intercept, but they do a lot of good work, even if their major backer is an odd libertarian bird from Silicon Valley. I guess they might feel similar as somebody who's working for a Murdoch business and is still trying to be an authentic journalist. I'm not sure. But I haven't sorted that out, but there it is. All right. From the, actually, the most recent intercept in the series, despite this special edition, which is I haven't heard yet, and it's going to be hard to hear. But this starts out with stuff about the Bernie bro idea. There's now this story flying around about how Russians are backing the Bernie campaign, and at the same time there are accusations made by Sanders himself that maybe these tweets that went on in Nevada and all this personal attack and attacking the Culinary Union and attacking Nicaraguan women and all this despicable stuff that's going on that he's disavowed could be from alternate sources. And it points to the Russians because they're the perhaps the easiest ones, but as we have Roger Stone, the champion of dirty tricksters, dirty tricks are as American as apple pie. And it isn't just fake news of the Trump campaign. It was Karl Rove's speciality, is releasing false stuff and getting somebody to avow it and then disavow it, and we gotcha, and all right. But I think the essay by Scaho is worth checking out, so I'm not slewing forward in that.
The former New York City mayor releasing an ad attacking the senator's supporters, the so-called Bernie bros, for their behavior online.
And the Bernie bros, again, they're pretty obnoxious, and they're very sexist and misogynist. So
what is the tactic besides using bad language and scaring people?
They've called Elizabeth Warren a snake. They called Pete Buttigieg a rat.
Is that what you want from a Bernie Sanders supporter?
What we used to call Bernie bros, which I think is now way too limiting a term, savaging them online.
Does that behavior reflect on Sanders' ability to bring the country together? You've seen all those reports.
These people on the left who have large Twitter followings, look, I know you don't like us. I know you're going to keep fucking tweeting at us. Fine, do whatever the fuck you want.
Now, Mr. Bloomberg, like anybody else, has a right to run for president. He does not have a right to buy the presidency.
This is Intercepted. I'm Jeremy Scahill, coming to you from the offices of The Intercept in New York City, and this is episode 117 of Intercepted.
There was a guy, Bernie Sanders, who would have beaten Donald Trump. The polls show he would have walked away with it. But Hillary Clinton got the nomination for a variety of reasons.
Former New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg has been absolutely bombarding the television, radio, internet airwaves with a nearly $500 million advertising blitz. And that's just the publicly reported number.
Juntos vamos a reconstruir la nación. Soy Mike Bloomberg y apruebo este mensaje.
Bloomberg has already hired a staff of thousands of people across the country. That's more than most general election campaigns ever have. He's paying people to manufacture memes on his behalf. And we should also point out that Bloomberg didn't just come out of nowhere with this presidential run. He spent years pouring money into local and state candidates and organizations that he, wink, wink, knew would have to back him when he decided to pull the trigger and actually run. In some ways, it's sort of a clever and legalized form of bribery available only to the super rich. And it's pretty clear that it is a factor in why Bloomberg has gotten some mayors and lawmakers to publicly endorse him. And I can't shake the feeling that the tenor of some of the Bloomberg endorsements and ads, they feel like we're in some scene from The Manchurian Candidate, as Bloomberg's well-known, well-documented, atrocious record on so many public policies is completely ignored or historically revised.
Raymond Shaw is the bravest, kindest, warmest, most wonderful human being I've ever known in my life.
Now, there are a lot of problems with many of the candidates running for the Democratic nomination, but there are major issues in Mike Bloomberg's personal, business, and political past that make him a uniquely atrocious candidate to offer up as the person to replace Donald Trump or even as some sort of a acceptable alternative to Trump.
But if there's anybody that has changed this city, it is Donald Trump. He really has done an amazing thing, and this is another part of it. Donald, thank you for your confidence.
Michael Bloomberg has advocated economic policies that dehumanize and punish the working class. He's opposed increasing the minimum wage. He's fought unions. He's even suggested in a way that to be successful at his workplace, people should not go to the bathroom or eat.
Make sure you're the first one in there every day and the last one to leave. Mm-hmm. Don't ever take a lunch break or go to the bathroom. You keep working. You never know when that opportunity is going to come along.
The way Bloomberg speaks about manual labor seems to have this elitist tinge to it, rooted in old-fashioned ignorance.
To be a farmer, it's a process. You dig a hole, you put a seed in, you put dirt on top, add water, up comes the corn.
Bloomberg has not only made utterly racist statements on numerous occasions, he's implemented policies of racial terror to back up those sentiments.
They just keep saying, oh, it's a disproportionate percentage of a particular ethnic group. That may be, but it's not a disproportionate percentage of those who witnesses and victims describe as committing the murder. In that case, incidentally, I think we disproportionately stop whites too much and minorities too little.
Michael Bloomberg supported George W. Bush and Dick Cheney and endorsed their reelection. He backed the Iraq War, even though he had no public reason to do so. And he continues to say that he supports that decision.
Last month, presidential candidate and American oligarch Michael Bloomberg told the LA Times that the U.S. invasion of Iraq was a mistake, but one that was made honestly by those in power.
Bloomberg's statements on Medicare, Medicaid, healthcare in general include some remarkably cold-hearted comments that boil down to, if you're old and poor, we should probably cut costs by just letting you die or wither away.
Yeah, if you show up with prostate cancer, and you're 95 years old, we should say, go and enjoy, have a nice day, lead a long life. It's no cure. And you can't do it. If you're a young person, we should do something about it. Society's not willing to do that yet.
Bloomberg has railed against so-called entitlements. In other words, social spending or safety net programs.
Let's get serious. The entitlements are going to bankrupt us, just like the pension system and healthcare is going to bankrupt corporations.
Bloomberg also has made astonishingly ignorant statements about education and schools.
You would cut the number of teachers in half, but you would double the compensation of them, and you would weed out all the bad ones and just have good teachers. And double the class size with a better teacher is a good deal for the students.
It is clear that Michael Bloomberg is trying to buy this race. He's also trying to do everything in his power to stop Bernie Sanders from getting the nomination. And we now see Bloomberg running attack ads against Sanders with ominous music, making it seem like overwhelmingly random or anonymous social media accounts are actually official Sanders campaign statements, or that they're from his campaign manager or his spokespeople, rather than mostly random people on social media. Bloomberg also had the audacity to put out a press release attacking Bernie Sanders and saying he is a, quote, new bro of Donald Trump. Bloomberg was trying to play OK Boomer cute by using the Bernie bro framing. But you know what? The majority of the Bloomberg campaign statement was spent attacking observations made by senior black women in the Sanders campaign, namely Nina Turner and Breonna Joy Gray. Bloomberg has far more in common with Donald Trump than he does with ordinary people in this country, on a personal and public level. He has dozens and dozens of complaints, lawsuits, non-disclosure agreements, stemming from his vile and misogynistic comments about women having children, about women's bodies, and complaints alleging workplace gender-based harassment. And Bloomberg, of course, won't release any of these women from their non-disclosure agreements so that their stories can be investigated. These are two men, Donald Trump and Michael Bloomberg, who speak about women in disgusting terms, who have repeated battles with women accusing them of all sorts of misconduct. But they yuck it up on the golf course, and as Bloomberg has said, they move in some of the same social circles. On today's show, we are going to continue our look into the record of Michael Bloomberg. A little bit later in the show, we're going to examine how Bloomberg presided over an NYPD program to surveil and spy on Muslim Americans, their businesses, and their places of worship. But we begin first with the big picture of what Bloomberg's campaign means for the Democratic primary and potentially for this country and the world. I'm joined now by Nikhil Pal Singh. He is professor of social and cultural analysis and history at New York University, founding faculty director of the NYU Prison Education Program. Nikhil is a historian of race, empire, and culture in the 20th century United States, also the author most recently of Race and America's Long War. He's also the author of Black is a Country, Race and the Unfinished Struggle for Democracy. Nikhil Pal Singh, welcome back to Intercepted.
Thanks, Jeremy. Great to be here.
Your big picture analysis of what's at play here.
Bloomberg clearly
he's had a plan. He's had an idea that he could run for higher office, that he could essentially crack the Democratic Party, similar to the way that Trump cracked the Republican Party. Of course, Trump didn't have to use so much of his own money. He doesn't have as much money as Bloomberg. But I think now the dynamic is a little bit different, the one that Bloomberg's confronting, because he's confronting the momentum that Sanders has had coming out of 2016. And Sanders obviously represents an entirely different trajectory. He represents the possibility of returning the Democratic Party to its kind of labor-left roots, which it abandoned decades ago. The fact that Sanders has gotten so much traction and has so much popularity among ordinary Democrats, as well as among a pretty committed base, I think presents Bloomberg with a real problem and presents Democrats who call themselves progressives, many of whom have been deeply reliant upon Bloomberg funding at various points, whether in their nonprofit careers or in their careers as elected officials, also with a problem, because Bloomberg is clearly not the candidate who represents the progressive standpoint on issues of racial justice, on issues of gender equality, on schooling, on policing. So how do you then square support for Bloomberg as the kind of candidate that is going to be, say, the one to stop the Sanders momentum?
We've seen Bloomberg spending a lot of money, record-setting money on ads. But if you go back and look at the last week or so, he got hit very hard by his stop-and-frisk record. And it seems now this week that we're seeing the kind of official response to that, which is to run attack ads going after alleged Bernie Sanders supporters and saying, look at this kind of mob violence and harassment online. And he's doing an ad buy now, pushing this ad about the so-called Bernie bros.
It's so clear what's happening here. Bloomberg presided over what may be one of the world's largest municipal police forces that was essentially committed to a campaign of racial terror in relationship to the city's Black and Latino residents. Some 5 million stops. You have 90% of the stops and frisks being of Black and Latino men and women under the pretext of looking for weapons, usually. And they came up with a weapon 1% of the time. So you have stopped 5 million people, and this is your return on a policy that is essentially terrorizing people. And they never backed down from it. The courts forced them to abandon it. The police arguably never fully abandoned it. So there's a kind of stop and frisk light that's been going on ever since. So it's still in force in many respects. And Bloomberg would rather everybody forget this. So here we have a kind of classic diversion of our era in which a policy of kind of massive state aggression that ran, let's say, parallel to the massive state aggression of the Iraq War, right? So you've got stop and frisk on New York City streets. You've got torture in Guantanamo and Abu Ghraib. And now people are turning around and saying, no, 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 no. The real violence, the real abuse, the real harassment is coming from Bernie Sanders' troll army.
Of the Bernie Online Brigade. And here's what he says. He says, no other candidate has anything like this sort of digital brown shirt brigade. I mean, except for Donald Trump.
The vicious, malicious, misogynistic things they said, the threats they put out. And to say I disassociate is one thing. Find out who the hell they are. If any of them work for me, fire them. Find out.
Do you feel like he's done enough to condemn the culture online that stems from his movement?
I've said before that we are all responsible for what our supporters do.
I think people know that we live in a society in which state-sanctioned violence has been unleashed over the last couple of decades. And yet most liberals are preferring to look away from that and then to identify the source of violence with something that is actually essentially trivial and something that does not in any way put them at risk personally behind their keyboard in the comfort of their living room where they could easily mute the person who's saying whatever horrible thing they're saying. And I'm not saying people should say horrible things to each other online. I don't think it's a great practice, but it's not violence.
You had a pretty provocative tweet over the weekend, and I just want to ask you to extrapolate on it and explain what exactly you're talking about here. This is what you wrote. Going to be wild when Trump runs to the left of Bloomberg on criminal justice reform and cracks 10% of the African-American vote, thus ensuring victory. First of all, explain why you believe that's a possibility.
Trump got 6% of the African-American vote in 2016. That once again shows that African-American voters are massively committed to vote for the Democratic Party, as they have been for decades. Most analysts who look at the electoral numbers over the last several elections recognize that one of the measures of Obama's significant victory in 2008 was a massive turnout of the Democratic base, including a heavy turnout among African-American voters. That's always something that the Democratic Party is banking on, is hoping for. Trump, I think, recognizes, especially now, an opportunity to shave a little bit of that off, either to suppress the African-American vote, which is one tactic that Republicans have pursued for the last couple of decades through various kinds of voter suppression measures, or to try to co-opt a little bit of the African-American vote by appealing to them on the one issue of reform that the Trump administration has embraced, the First Step Act, criminal justice reform. And Trump ran an ugly nativist campaign in 2016, and yet he got 28% of the Hispanic vote. People usually don't realize that. Liberals love to frame the issue as Trump is a racist, Trump is a racist, Trump is a racist. He couldn't possibly appeal to voters of color. Well, that's just simply not true. Bloomberg, his opponent, is uniquely weak on this issue because of what we've already discussed. His practices as mayor of New York City over a very long period of time in which he presided over a stop and frisk policy that is obviously prima facie in every sense, deeply racist and racially divisive.
You know, Nikhil, one of the reasons I really enjoy speaking with you in this crazy era we're in is that you're one of the people I look to who's able to kind of go up to 30,000 feet and look at the bigger picture. And I'm wondering if you could try to place the Bloomberg candidacy, place it in a broader historical context of the history of presidential elections in this country and what it says about our democratic institutions.
The fact that Bloomberg can enter with these huge ad buys and this massive payroll suggests just how perilous and dysfunctional our political system has become. It's not surprising that at this moment in history, we could be actually facing a campaign between two billionaires running what have essentially been kind of astroturf campaigns, quote unquote, grassroots movement.
Right, fake grassroots. Right,
yeah. Fake grassroots. That's what astroturf means. But I think this decay in our politics has been progressing for a long period of time. There's partisan polarization around mostly cultural issues or issues that are understood to be cultural, even as both parties are heavily, heavily in the pockets of big donor interests and with enormous fealty to corporate interests, to defense interests. So it's kind of a paradox, right? It's like we're told we're in this like tremendously polarized era, and yet does the defense budget ever do anything but go up? Is there ever anything less than bipartisan support for measures that are favorable to big corporations? We're in this period in which American politics has been adrift for a long time and in which the parties are kind of disaligning in different ways.
Amy Klobuchar has really kind of made it a point to point out that she voted for the U.S.-Mexico trade agreement.
What do you know about the Mexican president?
I know that he is the Mexican president.
But so. Can you tell me his name?
No.
When the candidates were asked, who's concerned about the Democrats running a self-avowed socialist, she was the only one who raised her hand.
Yeah. The question should be, why didn't everyone else raise their hand? But they didn't, because people are looking at each other, and it may not be popular, and you're going to anger some people. But I believe in leading and doing what you think is right. And that's why I raised my hand, because I am troubled by having a socialist lead our ticket.
That has segued now into a real intensification of red baiting and going after Sanders.
There were executions in Central Park, and I might have been one of the ones getting executed. And certain other people would be there cheering, okay? So I have a problem with people who took the other side. I don't know who Bernie supports over these years.
And there's selectively edited video clips that have been circulating around from Bernie Sanders visiting the Soviet Union right before the fall of the Berlin Wall, where he was praising the veneer of the metro system.
The stations themselves were absolutely beautiful. Including many works of art, chandeliers that were beautiful. It was a very, very effective system.
But the way in which that kind of overt red baiting is now intensifying in the campaign, your thoughts on it?
That's what they're going to go for. They're going to go for the idea that Bernie is the left Trump, that his supporters are a virulent mob, unthinking mob, and that Bernie's policies are going to lead the country to an era of, empty grocery stores and drab gray conformism, the sort of old Cold War sort of visions of state socialism as undynamic, as undemocratic, as repressive, And of course, they're also using the kind of Russiagate stuff against Bernie, you know, like who would Putin prefer, Trump or Sanders? You know,
I'd like to ask that exact question to some of Hillary Clinton's most prominent supporters, who they would support, Trump or Sanders.
Oh, yeah. No, I think
I'm dead serious. I'd love to hear the answer to that.
Oh, I think it's a very important point, because the institutional Democratic Party would rather see Sanders lose than win against Trump. I think there's sensible people in the Democratic Party that understand that Sanders is, in many ways, a very ordinary politician. And although he takes the label democratic socialism, what he essentially wants is to make the playing field fairer again, to restore higher levels of redistribution so that ordinary people can access healthcare and education. Over 50% of American workers earn less than $15 an hour. I mean, the wealth skew in this country has become so staggering, and most people are struggling to do the basic things like pay rent, educate their children, and get the kind of health care that they need.
I think the real threat to them is a Bernie Sanders victory would necessitate there being huge voter turnout, a groundswell of support for the vision and ideas represented by his campaign, and it would shatter into a million little pieces the way that the Democratic Party has existed for many, many decades. That's the threat to their fiefdom.
Absolutely. It's a huge threat to the institutional architecture of the Democratic Party as constructed under the Democratic Leadership Council and the Clintons, which moved the party away from its base in labor and social movements and in the aspirations of ordinary working people towards a party that was much more beholden to elite financial and corporate donor interests to match the Republicans, and to then play this kind of forked tongue game where they speak to the needs of ordinary people. Yes, everyone should have health care. But then when it comes down to it, they're in the boardroom with the lobbyists of United Healthcare, having those lobbyists dictate what is possible in terms of health care policy. Bernie Sanders is the first politician that we have seen in my lifetime who is not going to do that. And that does not mean that Bernie Sanders will not compromise politically to get things done. He is a pragmatist. He's been in organized institutional politics for a long time. But Bernie has been very, very clear about his positions, and he hasn't waffled in the ways that other politicians have. And the Democratic Party, at sort of its elite institutional level, sees that as an existential threat. There's no question. And think about it. What would you prefer? Another 4 years at the center of American progress, where you can fundraise off of every lousy, racist, sexist, ugly thing that Trump does and says. And you can fundraise, and you can fundraise, and you can fundraise. And you never have to change one thing that you really do, right? And you personally are going to continue to pay very low taxes from where you sit in the social order. You're going to continue to enjoy a lifestyle in a coastal city where you are well protected by a well-armed police force that makes sure that you don't have too many homeless people on the street. How has daily life changed for coastal elites under Trump? Almost not at all.
What are the issues about Sanders that concern you, given that he very well may be president? He very well may win. So I'm asking you now to take off the hat of the electoral politics and say, if we're just looking at this as a potential commander-in-chief president, what concerns you about Bernie Sanders?
I think the toughest issue that faces an American president is going to be the increasing turn towards nationalism as a organizing idea within international politics, and an organizing idea that also relates to how we think about border politics and immigration policy. Because one of the things that Trump clearly has tapped into, and it's not just Trump, it's happening all over Europe and it's happening in other parts of the world, really is the idea that we're kind of in a new era of international competition and even kind of predation, in which the role of the nation state is to protect its people. And in that narrative, which is a narrative of trade war, and is also a narrative about climate change, this is the environment that we're in, very fertile ground for the right. Okay, because the right actually can pivot a little bit left on economics. It can say, we're going to exact these concessions from corporations, breaking up big tech or, you know, more regulation, things like that. They sound similar in some ways to some of the things that someone like Elizabeth Warren is saying. You know, but the nationalist right is moving in this direction, right? And the center, the Bloomberg type of figure, they would like to kind of keep this sort of financialized globalization in which Americans sort of increasingly basically just get accustomed to the fact that we are a poorer, low-wage country on balance, you know, with a kind of wealthy overclass. And that this will be this sort of ultimately an arrangement that can work for a long time because it will be leavened with some paternalism and some kinds of, you know, givebacks to the plebeians. Bernie or any left politician has to try to find something that is different in that framing of the problem. Already that framing suggests the challenge of how do you produce a world in which you start to think about benefiting your own people, but in a context where you are actually trying to produce higher levels of international cooperation and coordination in the interests of trying to address some of these problems that cross borders. I think that Bernie has the wherewithal to, and because he has a background that...